72. For tonight, a chance of rain before about 1 a.m. Otherwise, lows will be near 53. For tomorrow, showers are likely, mainly between 1 p.m. and 5 p.m. Mostly cloudy. Otherwise, highs will be in the upper 60s. And for tomorrow night, about a 40% chance of showers, mainly after 1 a.m. Mostly cloudy skies. Otherwise, lows will be around 43. This is WGTD, Kenosha, Racine, Elkhorn, and Lake Geneva. You've been listening to the morning news.
Welcome you to the Wednesday morning show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. We're going to be spending the next few minutes of WGTD's morning show talking about something very, very ordinary and yet in some ways quite wondrous, and something that is very, very easy to take for granted. In fact, just about all of us take for granted to a large extent butter. And yet it is something we should not take for granted. It is something with a rich, fascinating history. And it plays a very, very important role in so much of what we eat and enjoy. And I have come to a wonderful new appreciation for butter after reading an absolutely fascinating book called Butter, A Rich History. The book is written by Elaine Kosrova, who is a proud graduate of the CIA, the Culinary Institute of America. She has written extensively about food and cooking. She was an editor at Country Living Magazine, has written for other important journals and magazines as well, and is devoting her expertise and writing talents now to butter. Not only its modern-day presence in our kitchens, and but also its long and intriguing history, as well as its amazing variety. If one looks around the world to the dizzying array of types of butter from various cultures. The book is published by Algonquin Books, and again, it's called simply Butter, A Rich History. Elaine Kosrova, we welcome you to the morning show.
Thank you, Greg. And I have to say, it's great to hear your description of the book and sort of your new butter appreciation, because you know, my original title for the book was called Butter and Appreciation.
Ah, that would have been good. But I like Butter, A Rich History very much as well. I want to read a quick moment that I especially love from the first chapter of the book when you write this. I want to see. You're talking about how when one looks at a pasture and you see cows grazing, it's sort of amazing that out of a cow eating grass can come golden butter. You write, there's a Rumpelstiltskin-like magic to these dairy conversions. Even if modern science can explain the processes in cold detail, I find them no less dazzling. In fact, as I discovered writing this book, knowing all the intricate workings of animal nature and human endeavor that turn plant life into butter only added to my fascination. And yet, butter is uniformly taken for granted. It is common, after all. The girl next door, lovely but overlooked. Even for me, a food professional with more than two decades of experience as a pastry chef, test kitchen editor, and food writer, butter has long lived in the culinary shadows. My work paid and trained me to seek out the exotic, the celebrity foods, the next big thing, not a simple yellow stick that's in everyone's fridge. I want you to tell our listeners what you go on to describe from there, an experience that you had several years ago, which in a sense opened your eyes to just how fascinating and varied something as simple as butter, in fact, is.
Yes, happy to do that. That was my aha moment. So I, at the time I was working for, so this would have been about 9 years ago, I was working for a restaurant trade magazine as a food editor, and we did a lot of product samples for chefs, product tastings for chefs. And one day I had to sit down and do a tasting of butters. And some were imported, some were domestic butters. And, you know, it was kind of a routine thing to do these tastings, and I wasn't thinking, oh, you know, I mean, butter, it's so elemental, really, like, how interesting is this going to be? And I was actually quite astonished because I found the colors and the textures and the flavors had so many nuances. It was no different than, you know, doing like a flight of Pinot Noir or something. It was really fascinating to me and kind of mystifying because I thought at the time, you know, how do I account for these differences? Butter is essentially cream that's just simply agitated. So how do you get these wonderful variations and nuances? And so that really got me started on, you know, paying attention to butter, which I had not done up until that time.
And of course, it sounds like you were really unprepared for just what a complex story it is, even in the present day, let alone when one looks around the world and when one looks through history. I mean, I suspect butter ended up taking you on a ride for which you were really not fully prepared.
Yeah, yeah, which was completely delightful and fascinating. And I have to say, it doesn't even feel like it's over because there are butter regions in the world I have not yet been to. You know, I traveled to about five different countries for this book, including Bhutan and India. But I'd love to get to North Africa and Ethiopia. They have their own particular history and even now, you know, modern uses for butter. So, yeah, it's been absolutely fascinating, you know, and I have to say I love the irony, the fact that this was right under my nose most of my life, this epic story, and I just never knew it was there.
Mm. You do mention that you traveled to three different continents in search of sort of the more hidden or obscure corners of the story and history of butter. How did you, in a sense, know where to go? I mean, just take us through the process by which you did all of the research and field study that ultimately led to this fascinating book being written.
Well, that was very much helped by the fact that in 2008, I was hired to be the editor of a new magazine all about cheese called Culture Magazine. And I was with that magazine almost 5 years, so I spent a lot of time behind the scenes in the dairy world and first, you know, came to understand, oh, there's goat butter and there's sheep butter and actually there's water buffalo butter, because I was, you know, sort of embedded in the dairy world. And it was really through that association I began to just see the global picture of dairy and, you know, came to understand there's yak butter. And in history, there's even been things like reindeer butter. We don't really see that anymore. But just understanding the whole ruminant category of animals, when you realize it's not just about cows, then you start to, you know, get the grand picture of what butters are possible.
One thing I appreciated, and I was just trying to find it, and I'm not seeing it now, but I remember you stating pretty clearly that basically there's nothing wrong at all with the standard butter that most of us buy in the grocery store. Absolutely. And I really appreciated the fact that you took a moment to say that, because I think it is far more common when somebody explores something like butter or cheese or bread or whatever it might be, that typically the implicit message, and often the very explicit message as well, is you poor ignorant people, wasting your lives consuming run-of-the-mill ordinary butter when you could be enjoying yak butter from New Zealand or whatever. I really appreciate the fact that you are not out to put down the normal butter that most of us normally consume.
Not at all. In fact, we should be really grateful for what the industrialists have done, because they give us such a consistent product. You know, all of our cooking comes out the same. You know, it's a very clean, pure product. You know, before this model, I mean, butter was really kind of all over the place, sort of pre-industrial age, as far as quality and even, even its safety to some degree. So, I have no gripe at all, a grudge against the industrialists. I'm not in favor of industrial dairying. I think, I'd love to see smaller farms with, less cows, so they have lots of pasture to graze on. That would be the ideal. But that's really a separate issue. You know, when the cream comes to the butter plant, it's treated really well. In fact, I didn't know this. I was discovered in my research. I went to Grassland Dairy, in fact, which is in Wisconsin, and began to understand that the cream that comes to the factory is put through this gentle tempering process, and the point of that is to get just the right ratio of soft and hard fats in the cream. It's hard to imagine that cream has hard fats, but they have these little crystalline fats. And if you have just the right ratio, you get that smooth, cohesive butter that we totally take for granted in the supermarket these days. So that's an extra step that came with modernization. Sometimes you can get lucky and have just the right ratio if you're making butter yourself. But, as I said, the industrialists have really perfected the process.
Right. You tell us that making butter is actually quite a simple process, at least in some respects, particularly, I think you tell us, in comparison to, for instance, making one's own cheese or making one's own yogurt. Can you just explain, in a sense, the simplicity of the essential process by which butter is made?
Yes. It's simply a process of agitation. It doesn't require any cooking. It doesn't require any special equipment. You can literally take a glass jar, fill it half full of cream, and shake the heck out of it, and you'll get butter. And I think a lot of us have made it by accident, in fact, just whipping cream too far. So that's how simple it can be. And essentially what's happening during that agitation, no matter what equipment is doing the process, is you're basically breaking a tiny membrane that's around every single fat molecule. And that membrane is what keeps the kind of fat suspended in the liquid of the cream. It allows it to kind of float around. But once you break that membrane by agitating it, the fats all come together. They want to sort of coalesce together. And that's what you see when, if you've made butter and you suddenly see, oh my gosh, there's pieces of butter, and there's this liquid buttermilk left over. That's all it is. That's all you do. Mm. Of course, you can pre-treat the cream and culture it. You can work it in different ways afterwards to get a slightly different texture. The actual churning process is the simplest part of butter making, and the most straightforward. It's what you do before and after, where you can get nuances in the butter.
And in your chapter called Early Churnings, the subtitle says a lot, From Accident to Precedent. You tell us that, although it's certainly difficult, if not impossible, to really know for certain. There's a very good chance that the first butter was created entirely by accident. Explain sort of the scenario that is most likely about butter's ultimate origination.
Yes, well, so we're talking probably at least 9,000 years ago, if not earlier, before that. And what we surmise is that a shepherd, you know, milking his goat or sheep, it wouldn't have been cows at that point because cows were domesticated later, but milking his herd, you know, puts that milk then into a vessel. Usually it would have been a goat skin because they're not porous, so you can use a goat skin as a sack to carry milk. And so the milk goes into this sack, you know, and it's naturally starting to culture a little bit, to ferment a little bit, because, of course, there's no refrigeration and there's all this wonderful bacteria around. But at that point, the milk would have been, we're painting this picture of the milk then being put on the back of an animal or perhaps just on the back of the shepherd, and it gets walked, you know, up the hill, over the next hill, you know, for a good half hour, 45 minutes. So it's essentially rocking back and forth, and it's agitating those fat molecules that I spoke of earlier, so that by the time the shepherd got to his destination and opened his pouch, you know, lo and behold, there were these floating morsels of what we call butter. At the time, they didn't have a name. And it most certainly would have been white in color. It wouldn't have been golden because goat and sheep butter are typically white, you know, naturally white. So that's, you know, that's how we speculate. That's more or less how it happened. And, of course, once butter was discovered in that way, it was immediately, you know, thought to be delicious, of course, but it also turned out to have many practical uses, as fats did in the day. They were used for medicine. They were used as lamp oil. They were used for waterproofing, you know, many different uses. And butter, so butter was, you know, highly valued.
One thing I was trying to understand as I thought about the earliest days of butter, and even actually a little more recent in history for that matter, is what sort of proportion of the milk that one could procure from one's own cows or goats or whatever animals you happen to have on hand, what sort of proportion of that milk would have typically been utilized for butter versus consumed simply as milk or converted into something like cheese? I mean, would butter have been a relatively modest amount of what the milk would have been used for?
Mm. Well, it depends on the culture and also the time in history that we'd be talking about. You know, in the Middle Ages, when urban centers began to develop, that's about the time when butter really became a commodity, because before that, most people were living very close to the land, and if they, you know, they were producing butter, they were the ones eating the butter. You know, it was very sort of hand-to-mouth existence, butter-wise. But when, so these urban centers started to develop and concentrate, you know, with population, they had to be, that was suddenly a market for foods to be brought in, not just butter, but, you know, many different foods. But at that point, you know, butter became even more valuable as a commodity, as a business, not just something that you made on the farm to sustain, you know, your family. And, you know, I found that in most Northern European cultures, butter became very much a sort of, it became sort of part of, you know, building the wealth of different nations in Northern European regions, particularly Denmark, Ireland, Scandinavian countries. It was very much a huge, thriving butter industry, in some cases much more so than cheese.
Mm.
But when you move to the Mediterranean region, it's less so, because it's such an oil-loving culture, mm-hmm, around the Mediterranean.
For those of you just joining us, I'm speaking with Elaine Kosrova, and we are talking about her incredibly interesting book called Butter, A Rich History, which explores the history of how butter came to be developed and the role that it has played in various cultures and countries all around the world, and through history, the way in which butter has been made, has changed, and the dizzying array of types of butter and flavors of butter, so vastly beyond just what we think of as the run-of-the-mill stick of butter that most of us have in our refrigerators. Elaine Kosrova, I want to make sure to give you at least a couple of minutes to talk about the chapter in the book that surprised me the most, chapter 3, called Sacred and Spiritual, in which you tell us in a way that we scarcely can believe that butter has been used in all kinds of symbolic ways in spiritual practice, including something that I had never heard of involving butter sculpture in Tibet, which has been, a much prized practice that one can still witness. But first, more in general, just talk about this aspect of butter, which is such an alien concept for most of us today.
Yeah, I talk about butter's metaphysical life. I have to say it was a big surprise for me. I knew about Tibetan butter sculpting, as you mentioned, but I didn't realize if you go back much earlier to 2500 BC, the ancient Sumerians had their own rituals that involved the use of butter. And then moving through history, ancient history, the Vedic Aryans had different rituals, the Druids, the Hindus, the Buddhists. Just around the world, I found this universal custom of honoring butter in this way and, celebrating butter as a sacred tool. And I think much of the reason that developed was because butter making itself, as I mentioned, is very valuable for early peoples for various reasons, but it's also mysterious. How is it that liquid milk, white milk, suddenly can yield these beautiful, rich morsels of fat that's essentially invisible, until you shake and rock the milk? And at other times it wouldn't work. Butter making, when you don't control the temperature very well, and the culturing process, when, again, this is back in the day when it would have naturally been cultured because there was no refrigeration. So those things made butter making much more challenging, thousands of years ago, even hundreds of years ago. So it was a temperamental process, but when it worked, it was like, whoa, it's a bit like finding a pearl in an oyster. How is this possible? So I think, that's at the heart of why butter was revered and used in so many sacred rituals and still continues today with Tibetan butter sculpting.
Right. And what's really intriguing, I'm so glad you make this point towards the end of this chapter, again called Sacred and Spiritual. You write, remarkably, butter has held a heightened spiritual role throughout human history while simultaneously keeping its utilitarian place in everyday life. For as long as anyone can tell, butter has uniquely bridged the secular and the sacred, the scientific and the supernatural in vastly different cultures. Covering these dual narratives that stretch across time and place, I couldn't help but wonder, why butter? Why did it become a global darling of both spirituality and domesticity? And I think that is such a good point because, in a sense, we're not talking about something that is incredibly rare and incredibly exotic and incredibly beautiful to look at. I mean, the way you open up an oyster and there's a pearl.
Right.
I mean, it's hard to think about butter in those terms. But as you say, because there is a bit of mystery that surrounds the process by which it comes into being, that may be at least one explanation for why it has served this other function that that most of us don't think about in, for instance, modern America.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Yeah. I also discovered that, you know, butter for some cultures, some of these spiritual groups, such as the Hindus, for instance, the, you know, butter represented kind of this path to enlightenment, particularly ghee, which is made from butter and used a lot in India. It's basically butter oil. But just as, like, you know, the cow takes the grass, we take the milk from the cow, you know, we get the cream, from the cream we get the butter, from the butter we get the ghee. So there's constant, you know, refinement down to something pure and golden, was very symbolic for the Hindus.
I want to be sure to also have you talk about chapter 4 of your book, which is titled Handmaidens of Flavor, Women Build the Butter Trade. This is when we come to understand the very important role played for many, many, many years by someone known as a dairy maid. First, I want you to talk about something that you point out in the chapter, namely the gender divide, which you say ran deep in the early dairy world.
Deep and wide, because, again, I found it to be quite universal that it was taboo for men to have anything to do with the dairy arts, as we call them. I mean, milking the cow, processing the milk, that was very much a female domain because it was so closely tied to, well, it is still closely tied to birth, lactation, fertility, you know, motherhood, essentially. So women had a complete monopoly on you know, this kind of work. And, you know, through that, more than their many other chores, but through butter making, they gained, you know, some respect and status in the community because butter, after all, was really valuable. And, again, still quite mysterious. You know, it wasn't until the 1800s that we began to really understand what's happening on a, you know, chemistry and molecular level. So, yeah, so this conferred to women, you know, some, as I said, some status that was really special. And you found, too, that it broadened their lives to some degree, because if you were the dairy maids and dairy wives who, you know, made the butter and then often packaged it in a particular way using special hand-carved butter molds, and then you would wrap these precious carved pieces of butter in soft lettuce leaves and bring it to market. So there was this, there was an aspect of sort of branding their butter and then bringing it to market and being part of that whole economic scene as opposed to just being at home all the time. You know, it gave women a certain entree into the business world, so to speak, and cash in hand, you know, that they could control in their own households, you know. So butter did a lot for women in the early days. You know, of course, it was still hard work, but everything they did was hard, right? I mean, yeah.
Well, and I appreciate, and of course, people who read your book can see all the fascinating detail about all that women did in their sort of indoor responsibilities, and it's a staggering list. I mean, not that the men weren't working hard outside. On all kinds of other things, but I mean, there was this incredible gauntlet that the typical farm wife was responsible for, and creating the butter was one of the most important aspects, and you talk about how on the typical manor or estate that someone who was employed as a dairy maid would be in a position that was certainly a step up, at least, from the more typical servant in the household, because the dairy maid was charged with something quite important and in some respects, at least, somewhat complex.
Yes. Yeah. All my research showed, you know, if you were a good dairy maid, you could always find a job anywhere. And that really wasn't many jobs for women in those days. So.
In this chapter, you take a moment to talk about something that's really pretty incredible. It involves one of history's most famous women and most pampered women, Marie Antoinette, and what is regarded as perhaps, in your words, one of her most extravagant indulgences, her laiterie d'agrément, her pleasure dairy. just say a quick word about this. This is quite fascinating and also says a lot about the place that butter might have in a household like Marie Antoinette's.
Yes. Well, so this pleasure dairy was an actual construction in her little village on the grounds of Versailles. She created this kind of bucolic little village called Hameau, and her pleasure dairy was at the centerpiece of this. And it was essentially a place where she would do a lot of informal entertaining, but it was inside. It was set up to be a working dairy, quite lavish, though, in fact. There was, you know, marble everywhere and porcelain milk buckets and, you know, the finest of every kind of tool you could imagine. And it's, you know, it's documented that she would go there with her ladies-in-waiting, and they would play at making butter and a little ice cream, maybe, cheese, things like that. So, you know, it was both recreation and also entertainment, you know, right on the grounds of Versailles. And, you know, this started a trend, basically, among very wealthy people in Europe to create these ornamental dairies, as they were known, pleasure dairies. And often there was actual real dairy right nearby where actual dairy maids would, you know, create the real product, because I don't think Marie Antoinette was quite experienced hand at making butter and cheese. So it was a little bit of, you know, dairy staging. But, you know, she loved it. Apparently she, you know, loved to let her hair down, and her husband built her a second one at another estate, which she never actually got to finish or enjoy.
Right, didn't live long enough to enjoy that. Yes. Mm-hmm. Yeah, as you finish out this particular conversation, you begin talking about something that's also kind of gives us some insight into this whole topic of butter, namely what you call celebrity butters that were eagerly sought by food sophisticates in Europe and North America. I mean, certain butters from certain butter producers that were regarded as just essential. If you had enough money to procure such wonderful butter, it's simply something you had to have. I want you in particular to talk about something that I'd never heard of, a Parisian specialty of perfumed butter. Just tell us a quick word about what this would involve.
Yeah, well, one thing I have to explain is that it was very common for these celebrity butters of the 18th and 19th centuries to be very lightly salted, which was completely unusual. You know, most of the butter in those times was heavily salted because that was the main means of preservation. Again, there's no refrigeration, and butter is most plentiful in spring and summer when it's the most warm outside. So to get a butter that was less salty, and I mean like 3 or 4 times saltier than what we are used to, to get one that's, you know, much less salty than that was really precious and special, and had to be sold in, you know, small, tiny little rolls, you know, for quite a bit of money, so they could actually taste the cream, you know, taste the butter and not just salt per se. So when you start out then with a much more, you know, mild, sweet butter, you're able to infuse it with various things because the salt isn't interfering with, you know, flavor. So apparently the butters in this particular part of the region outside of Paris were layered with, you know, they put down a layer of butter and then a layer of flower petals and then more butter and more flower petals, and they would wrap this in muslin and allow it to infuse for a day or more. I have not yet tried this, but it's on my list, to-do list, to see how this works. That was one of the things they did, you know, outside of Paris. I don't think anyone else was doing that in particular, but every country had its, you know, even in the States, the area around Philadelphia was called the Butter Belt, and it was considered, you know, excellent butter from that particular region.
We're speaking with Elaine Kosrova, author of a fascinating book called Butter, A Rich History. You know, it just occurred to me this second that that in the house where I grew up, down in the basement, we actually had an old-fashioned butter churn. I have not thought of this in years. No. We haven't had it in decades, but the bottom was sort of pottery, and there was a wooden plunger, so it was a typical kind of plunger butter churn, and I have no idea. I should ask my dad when I see him if he remembers where we got that. So at least to that extent, we had at least the roughest notion, that is my siblings and I, of this is something that you would use to churn butter. What we certainly didn't know, but we would know from reading your book, is the array of different kinds of churns that were developed over the years. Although I think you would probably hasten to add that all of them essentially did the same thing. I mean, churning is churning. Even if it happens in some kind of fancy stainless steel contraption, does it make much difference in the creation of butter in terms of the kind of churn that is used?
Well, you know, there's so many variables. It's often hard to, you know, pin down, is it this one thing that made that butter different or better? Because, you know, the fat molecules, as I said before, the soft and hard fats, those are always shifting, and cream changes throughout the lactation season from, you know, spring through summer, its qualities change. So it's a little bit hard to say that this churn or that churn, you know, has made the butter this particular, say, texture. It's often about texture when you're talking about churning, you know, using different kinds. Because we do, the gold standard is certainly to have a velvety, smooth texture. And if you over-churn a butter, you know, if it breaks, you know, the butter comes and you keep churning it and churning it and churning it, you will end up with eventually a greasy butter, because you will have released too many of those soft fats. So there is a certain technique that the butter maker develops, you know, depending on what kind of churn they're using. So, you know, I've used a food processor, I've used old-fashioned churns, I've, you know, shaken it, you know, a really primitive way. And I do see differences, but I can't say precisely, because the cream isn't always the same.
Mm. You do take a few pages in your book in chapter 6 called The Revolution to not only talk about some of the breakthroughs in technology that changed the way in which butter is created, but you also talk about the emergence of a competitor, namely margarine, or the more proper term of oleomargarine. Just sketch, first of all, the difference between standard butter and oleomargarine, which of course resembles it in so many different ways, and nearly supplanted it for a time.
Yes, indeed. Yeah, I think there could be a whole book based on the margarine and butter battles that went on for about 90 years in this country. And by battles, I mean mostly legal battles. Through the butter makers tried through legislation and regulation and taxation to drive the margarine producers out of business. But just to back up a little bit, I think most people would be surprised to learn that the first margarine, which was invented in 1869, was created by a French chemist, and it was made with beef fat and a little bit of milk and some natural food coloring and salt. So it was quite different than the margarine that we know of today, which is made with vegetable oils.
Hmm.
And it was developed early on by this French chemist because Napoleon III wanted a spread that would be more affordable to feed his troops and that would travel better. But also margarine, you know, immediately kind of gained popularity when it came to the States, and that was like at the 1885, around that time, because there was quite a lot of bad butter on the market, and the low quality, and this would have been like moldy butter, rancid butter, dirty butter. There's quite a lot of that on the market, and that was what only the poor could afford. You know, they couldn't afford the better butters. And so when margarine came on the scene, it was more palatable. You know, it kept better. It just tasted better, and it was quite affordable. So it was immediately popular with people, you know, who couldn't afford good butter. And then from that sort of consumer base, it started to grow and you know, gain more popularity as the technology changed.
Right.
Better margarine.
So explain the lengths to which the dairy industry went to fight off the challenge of butter. I mean, of margarine. I mean, going so far as to have it in some locations criminalized.
Yeah, well, in Canada, it was completely outlawed. Just you know, here in the States, we went from state to state. Each state was making its own regulations, and some of them would eventually be undone by federal courts because they were preposterous. Things like margarine had to be dyed pink or black so as not to be confused with butter, but, you know, clearly to make it very unappealing as a food as well. It's a fascinating story of basically the rise of the special interest state.
Right. You know, as you describe this fascinating sort of subplot of how in many places, I mean, in I think you say at one point 30 states, you couldn't dye the margarine to make it look like butter, and then in some states it had to be dyed an unappetizing color like red or black or pink. And you make a great observation here when you say the color wars constituted an attack on the poor as well as the oleo producers, for its effect was to stigmatize margarine and its users who couldn't afford real butter. That is, at a glance, you would immediately know, oh dear, that person can't afford real butter because they're spreading pink margarine on their toast.
Yeah.
I mean, this is a small chapter of our history that most of us know nothing about.
Right. Yeah, and it wasn't actually all that long ago. You know, in Wisconsin, I believe it's still on the books that you can't serve margarine in a public place unless someone asks for it, unless a customer asks for it. But the prisons and the schools have always had butter, unlike many other states where margarine's been used in those institutions.
You also tell us that during the Second World War, when butter was rationed, there were all kinds of means by which families would extend their butter supply by using things like unflavored gelatin and milk to stretch it further. But I want to make sure you have a moment or two to talk about another kind of butter battle. That is the battle over whether or not butter is good for us. There, of course, in quite recently, all kinds of things written that would discourage us from using butter. I mean, the contrary advice of someone like Julia Child aside, you tell us that, in fact, to do away with butter altogether is really a mistake.
Yes, I think, you know, it's a complex phenomenon. You know, what's been happening with fat in our diets in the last 60 years. And I do want to mention I have a degree in food and nutrition that I got in the early 80s. I graduated in the early 80s. And in researching this chapter, I basically had to unlearn virtually everything I was taught in the 80s about fat and cholesterol and calories and sugar. There was so many things that we surmised but didn't have the facts, you know, that turned out to be, you know, theories that have led us down the wrong road. And that's why, you know, people are starting to question this whole anti-fat campaign, because we're not any healthier for it. In fact, I believe for the first time in our history, the projected longevity of Americans is expected to go down, like within the next 10 years. because of the incidence of diabetes and heart disease, and well, diabetes and obesity, which lead to heart disease. And this is a direct result of having so many carbohydrates in our diets, particularly sugar. And sugar has flooded our diets because it was essentially put into many foods to replace the fat that we took out. We made foods, you know, lean, but kind of flavorless and less satisfying. But if you add more sugar, you know, you can make up for some of that, that blandness. So, you know, the fact that we went down this road is a story that begins like in the 1960s, particularly with one man, Ansel Keys, who was a physiologist. And, you know, he asserted that if you looked at countries around the world where there was little heart disease, there was less fat in their diet. Hmm. And, you know, he put up a chart to, you know, this was at World Health Organization big meeting, and, you know, put up this chart and showed this graph, you know, that looked like a direct correlation. You eat fat, you get heart disease. However, what was noted after was that he had access to the data from 22 countries, and he only listed 7 countries, the ones that supported his hypothesis. But if you looked at countries like France and Sweden and, you know, Scandinavian countries where they were eating quite a lot of fat, they had less than half the amount of heart disease that we did in the States.
Mm. So he was pointing to the wrong smoking gun in making his conclusions.
Well, it turns out, but, you know, it made a lot of sense to people at the
time. Of course, absolutely.
You eat fat, you know, you get fat in your body, but now we know it's nothing like that, really. It's so much more, you know, wonderfully complex.
Right. And we can read more about that, of course, in the chapter called Role Reversal.
Yes.
To finish up for just our last couple of minutes, I want you to just touch on the really interesting chapter called The Modern Buttersmith, Small Batches, Big Fans, in which you talk about this relatively modern phenomenon, which in some ways harkens back to an earlier time, but the ever-growing community of buttersmiths, as you term them, that are creating, in a sense, a whole new industry. Just say a quick word about what's out there, and how we can figure out what's worth exploring.
Yeah, I love that. You know, now in the 21st century, we have this incredible diversity. On the one hand, you know, we can rely on our industrial butters, but on the other side are these wonderful handmade artisanal butters that are popping up around the world. Partly, in many cases, it's to support the family farms that need to create value-added products to survive. You know, they can't just get by on milk anymore. So they're going back to, you know, making cheese and butter. That was the reason I traveled to so many places, in fact, was to see these sort of, I liken it to the craft beer movement. It's sort of the craft butter movement. And it's fascinating and wonderful to see, you know, these very sort of personal takes on butter. One of the most interesting was this guy who calls himself the Butter Viking, and he's Swedish, but he makes butter in England, and he does these wonderful cultured products. He does a butter mayo. He does, you know, he really plays like with the whole category of butter possibilities.
Hmm. Well, we want to mention also that your book includes some really wonderful-looking recipes also a couple of different interesting appendices, including one called Some Recommended Butters, in mm-hmm. which you spell out some really interesting varieties of butters that might be worth exploring, and another appendix, which is called Butter in Other Words, in which you share with us this wonderful array of terms from around the world for this thing called butter, this thing we are so quick to take for granted, but I think we're a lot less apt to do so once reading your incredibly interesting book. Again, it's called Butter, A Rich History. It's published by Algonquin Books. It includes plenty of photographs and diagrams and illustrations, which further enrich this thorough portrait of butter. and the author, Elaine Kasrova. Elaine Kasrova, I've thoroughly enjoyed both your book and this opportunity to speak with you about it. Thank you so much.
Me too. Thank you. Clearly, you read the book and appreciated it. That means a lot to me. Thank you.
You're welcome.